From the Gateway to the West, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Now, what you are about to hear tonight is a major disclosure event as we talk about time travel. Perhaps the cover-up will end as one of America's early time space explorers will step forward to reveal what he experienced, what he learned during the early years of time travel research and development by the United States government. Andrew D. Bashargo, a lawyer, writer, Mars researcher, and planetary whistleblower. He will bring his campaign, and he will relate his childhood experiences in DARPA's Project Pegasus. Andrew is next on Coast to Coast AM.
You're tuned to Coast AM on News Radio 1190 KEX.
And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Andrew Bashargo, our special guest tonight, as we talk about truly an incredible story called Project Pegasus. Andy, welcome to Coast, my friend. How are you?
Good, George. Thank you for having me on.
Good. Tell us about you.
Well, I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Washington State, and I'm a writer. I hold five academic degrees, including a BA in history from UCLA and a Master of Philosophy from the University of Cambridge. I've been busy developing a profile in the disclosure movement in the sense that I've been leading a campaign to lobby the U.S. government to disclose several controversial truths that I'm claiming the U.S. government is concealing. One is that Mars harbors life. That is to say, the red planet is an inhabited planet, and this can be demonstrated by an analysis of NASA's photographs from Mars. I wrote about that in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, which I published last year in 2008, which was the first paper to prove that Mars is an inhabited planet, and in fact, the first work to publish a photograph of a humanoid on another planet. Going back many more years, I was a participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus, which was essentially the U.S. time-space exploration program at the time of its emergence in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying my involvement, researching my involvement in Project Pegasus for 10 years now, in a personal quest to prove what happened to me and also to communicate my experiences to others. And next year I'm going to be publishing a tell-all book in which I describe my experiences in Project Pegasus and give an overview of the true story of the emergence of time travel in the U.S. defense technical community 40 years ago.
Andy, what happened to you as a child? How did you get involved in this?
Well, I can relate the first experience that I had in Project Pegasus when I was brought into the project. My dad was a senior projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company. We were living in Morris Plains, New Jersey, in north central New Jersey. And when I was 6 years old, he drove me from our home in Morris Plains up to the old Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey. Curtiss Wright was essentially a vast aerospace plant with many numbered buildings. And we went through the Air Museum there where the vintage Glenn Curtiss planes were on display. And we entered the engineering building and then into a building numbered Building 68. And in a room there in Building 68, there was a device that consisted of essentially of two parenthesis-shaped objects. They were about 8 feet tall and about 10 feet apart on the ground. And when my dad had the technician turn the device on, it propagated a curtain of energy that looked like it was sort of falling between the two armatures of the device, not unlike, let's say, water falling in a water sculpture at a public park.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad explained that he was going to hold my hand, and when he counted to three, we were going to jump through this curtain of energy, this curtain of radiant light, and we were going to find ourselves sort of in a tunnel moving forward, and that at a certain point, the tunnel would close, and we would find ourselves somewhere else on the face of planet Earth. And so we did so, and we arrived on a hillside in the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, New Mexico, several seconds later. So essentially we jumped through the curtain of energy. A vortal tunnel opened up in the fabric of the time-space continuum, not unlike the near-death experience that writers and researchers like our own Daniel Brinkley have described. And I could see on the side of the tunnel that there were sort of luminous effects of other events going on that were rushing by very quickly. And then suddenly we popped into view in Santa Fe, and the tunnel closed, and we had essentially teleported 2,000 miles across country in several seconds. So that was essentially my entry into DARPA's Project Pegasus. I quantum leaped from Woodridge, New Jersey to Santa Fe, and over the next 5 years, Santa Fe would be used as sort of the collection area for these teleportings that were going on from different similar labs around the country.
Now, when you talk about disclosure, Andy, and the push for it, you're talking about all facets of disclosure, aren't you?
Right. I'm really emphasizing two major themes, though, one on the surface of our planet and the other off-planet. With the Mars disclosure effort, this goal that I have to encourage President Obama to acknowledge the fact that Mars is an inhabited planet, what's driving that is my belief that as human beings on this planet, I believe we have a human right to a true telling of the natural history of the solar system that we inhabit. And I think that to the extent that Mars is inhabited and that we're beginning to visit Mars, part of the information that I'm going to be disclosing is that, in fact, U.S. personnel are already on Mars. And so we can predict that there will be even greater visitation, exploration, habitation, and colonization of the planet that every 2 years comes closest to our planet, which is the planet Mars. And so I think that it's critical that we disclose the truth to the American people and the people of the world that Mars is inhabited, because we're going to have to do the right thing regarding Mars. And I'm urging that we develop a UN protectorate for Mars under treaty as we begin to have further activity there.
Now, what is so fascinating, Andy, about this entire case is that, you're prominent. You're an attorney. You're a researcher. You really have nothing to gain with this story. Has it affected your career at all as you go forward with this?
No. In fact, it hasn't. It's amazing. I think there's a great, an abounding sort of desire and even an optimism on the part of the public now to move forward and embrace the critical issues that we're going to be confronting in the 21st century. And I think that people in my professional practice, my clients, fellow attorneys, have been very, encouraging of my truth campaign. It hasn't affected it negatively in any way. I think it's had a positive impact. Of course, the other major emphasis of my campaign is more of an issue in deep politics that my fellow attorneys can relate to, which is this desire to have the U.S. government disclose the teleportation capability that Project Pegasus achieved over 40 years ago, and it's been kept secret all these years.
Explain this device, which you call a Tesla teleportation device.
Well, it was essentially a device that was found in Nikola Tesla's papers at the time of his death in January of 1943. There were two teams of investigators that were rushing to his suite at the Knickerbocker Hotel in Manhattan. Two War Department agents and also two agents from the FBI. And the War Department agents got there first and seized Nikola Tesla's lab manuals, the papers of Nikola Tesla.
Yes.
Tesla's papers were never lost, My investigation over the last 10 years essentially proved that, in fact, they were forwarded to the individuals in the world who it would make the most sense to forward Tesla's shop manuals to, the physicists that were then gathering in Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build the atomic bomb. And this was a critical moment in the history of U.S. time travel research and development, because at that point, Tesla's work during the latter part of his career, during the last 15 or 20 years of his life, was weaponized. It was sequestered within the defense technical community because the war was on, and it was believed that the primary significance of the teleportation technology contained in his papers would be to enable the U.S. military to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. You know, all of those are marvelous veterans that Danion addressed tonight. The majority of them were injured, not on the front lines in combat, but getting to the front lines. And so it was hoped that teleportation would enable our military to strategically place troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. But the net effect of that decision, however appropriate it was during a time of world war, prevented teleportation from being introduced in the civilian sector as potentially our dominant form of transportation. And so my truth campaign around teleportation is to urge the president to declassify this technology so that we can implement it on a global basis to address the crisis of environment and development that we find ourselves in, the crisis of global warming, and launch a new Manhattan Project to establish teleports at all of the major transportation hubs around the world so that at least we'll have a fighting chance of achieving planetary sustainability.
Are you saying, though, Andy, that they've got the capability to teleport human beings like we saw in Star Trek?
No, in fact, George, the opposite was the basis of the technology. In fact, when we were small children being trained at the teleport at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey, by Jack Pruitt, who was one of the team leaders of Pegasus, he would go on, of course, and become the research director of Project Montauk later. We asked, is this going to be, you know, Star Trek was just then a new television show, 1966.
Sure.
We're being. I had my first teleport to Santa Fe in 67, 68. We were dropped officially into the program in the fall of 69 when I was a third grader. And our first question is this going to be like on Star Trek, where you stand on a little platform and I think it's one of the other children in the program put and turned into 1,000 bees of light.
That's right. And, beam me up, Scott.
Yeah. And so Jack explained, no, that the opposite is going to occur. He asked us what would happen, in fact, if teleportation was carried out like it was shown on Star Trek. And I volunteered the idea that if you disintegrated somebody, you would kill them. He said, that's right. You would stop their metabolic functioning. They would die. And they certainly might arrive somewhere, but not as a living organism. The teleportation technology that the U.S. government has been in possession of for now over 40 years, based on these schematics and mathematical formulae and an actual rendering of the device that was found in Tesla's papers, essentially works in an opposite way. It opens up a vortal tunnel or interstitial chasm, as it were, in the fabric of time-space. It essentially, when the individual teleportee jumps through that field of radiant energy, that curtain of light, of shimmering light.
Almost like Sliders, that show.
More like that, yes. The universe is actually wrapped around the teleportee, and they are repositioned when the tunnel closes. They're repositioned elsewhere in the time-space continuum.
How do they reposition it exactly to where they want it?
You know, I'm a lawyer and a writer, not a physicist, and in fact, I was a child on the in the project. I can say this, and that is, when we first began teleporting to Santa Fe, as a group of children, beginning in the summer of 1970, we had a number of jumps to Santa Fe. They were just sort of acclimating us to the experience of jumping through this field of light, finding ourselves traveling at this incredible velocity through a vortal tunnel in time-space. Could you ask your question again, George?
Yeah, we were talking about how they pinpointed you.
Oh, yes,
to specific
yes. I was talking about Santa Fe. What they had us do before we began those jumps in the summer of 1970 was we had to memorize the site map, you know, the street plan of Santa Fe, because during those years they couldn't pinpoint exactly where we would reemerge in the time-space continuum. So, in fact, not just the immediate state capitol complex there in Santa Fe was the collection area, but all of Santa Fe was the area that they were sending us to. So, in fact, I was involved in these activities at a time when it was still very new and dangerous and experimental. And, in fact, they were so concerned that we would not only not arrive in Santa Fe, but that we might arrive with some displacement in time in the past or future, that they selected places like Woodridge, New Jersey, where the Lenni Lenape Indian tribe had had existed for hundreds of years before it was settled by Europeans, and also an area of the country like Santa Fe, New Mexico, which had been the territorial capital of New Mexico in the Southwest for 400 years, because they were concerned that we would be lost in time, not in space like the TV show of that era, but actually displaced in time. And we actually had a seminar in which we were essentially educated what we should do if that should happen.
Did it ever happen with Project Pegasus, where they lost people by sending them off somewhere out there?
Well, during my investigation, I was informed by one source at CIA that several of the participants had literally been lost in time. There was one mishap on the project that I was a personal witness of, however, so I can certainly confirm that they weren't entirely certain what would happen when we would pop back into view. What happened was in the fall of 1970, we had a series of essentially rehearsals for that would involve having us jump into a certain location from different teleports around the country. I think this was in furtherance of the idea that they would send children to overseas locations to participate in espionage and not really be noticed as child spies. And so we were jumping through the teleport at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, and there were other children jumping through identical devices at different locations in different states in the eastern United States and in the Midwest. And I ran past a fountain, a public fountain there in the state capitol grounds. And right after I ran past that sort of monument there or fountain, there was a boy my age who was on the ground, and his feet had been entirely sheared off. And he was writhing in pain. You know, Daniel mentioned the plight of our courageous veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are the kinds of experiences that happen to those of us who are veterans in classified defense-related research and development activities. This boy had popped into view in the fountain there, and the fountain had been accidentally left on, so there was about 3 inches of water in the base of the fountain. And as a result, his feet arrived a split second after the rest of his body did, and he essentially slid off his ankles. And when I ran past his location, I could see that there were two red child's kid sneakers sitting in the fountain, and that his feet had literally been sheared off. And he was writhing on the ground, screaming, "My feet, my feet, I'm only 9 years old. What am I going to do without any feet?" So there were accidents in the testing of this technology. On one level, we were trainees. On another level, we were experimentees.
I was going to say, were you guinea pigs?
Well, I think that we were that, but we were also trainees, because they were expecting that we would be participants in a fully fledged time-space program that would emerge when we were older, that would essentially parallel the space program that NASA was then administering. So I think we were many things. We were trainees. We were experimentees. I know that they wanted to test the cognitive and physiological effects of this new Tesla-based teleportation technology on children, because obviously one of the strategic goals of having this would be to enable the president and other executive branch officials to teleport in a time-urgent way to different locations around the world, you know, between U.S. military bases, for example. And, of course, sometimes the president's children would go with him. And so they wanted to develop baseline information on how the experience of teleporting affected our thought processes, our ability to solve problems, and also just our basic physiological signs. And so when we began teleporting as a group of children in the summer of 70 to Santa Fe, we would then be bused up to an old school site in Lamy, New Mexico, and we'd go through a basic physical examination and then sit down and complete several hours of standardized testing. And so they were developing data on how the teleportation was affecting kids. They were familiarizing us with the experience of teleporting, and they were clearly also still working out some of the problems with the technology, because there was this mishap that I was actually an eyewitness to, involving a boy who lost his feet.
Were they planning then, as you said, you were trainees, they actually wanted you as a youngster so they could develop you later on as an adult?
Correct. They actually, one of the seminars that was held, it was actually explained to us that there would be a secret time-space exploration program that would be as fully developed as the overt space exploration program under NASA, but it would continue to be administered by DARPA with reporting requirements to the CIA. Now, those were the two principal agencies that were administering Project Pegasus. Project Pegasus fundamentally was a classified defense-related R&D program that was focused on remote sensing and time. It was hoped that it would be an intelligence-gathering program and become even more so in the future.
Andy, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back with this astonishing story on Coast to Coast AM.
Coast to Coast AM with George Newry. All night long on the Big One, News Radio 1190 KEX.
Andy, are there any scientists who are in this project then who are still in government today?
Boy, there aren't any scientists that I know of, because, of course, this project was 40 years ago, so even a 40-year-old mid-career professional would be at least 80 years of age today. But as part of my truth campaign, I am asking two of the project principals who went on to very distinguished careers in government to join my truth campaign and actually publicly appear with me to affirm the existence of this teleportation capability so that we can use it to advantage humanity. Let me explain who they are.
Sure.
All of these classified defense-related research and development projects have a defense attaché. This would be the person who would be the point man or woman between the Pentagon and project engineers, for example, like my late father, Raymond F. Bishago, who was one of the Ralph M. Parsons Company engineers on the project, or let's say to the Federal Science Administrator on the project, who was Harold M. Agnew, the director of the Los Alamos National Labs. The defense attaché to Project Pegasus, to this secret U.S. time-space exploration program that emerged in the late 1960s, was none other than Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. At that time, Mr. Rumsfeld had already served as an aviator during the Korean War for the U.S. Navy. He had already served in Congress. And during the time that he was working for President Nixon's Board of Wage and Price Stabilization, he was secretly serving as the defense attaché to this project under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. I had numerous interactions with Rummy as a child on the project, discussions that took place at lunches, dinners, in bars and so forth. He was very well respected in the project. The other individual, not a Republican but a Democrat, who was one of the principals, he wasn't as prominent as Secretary Rumsfeld, but he was on the project, was the young man who was taking role when the teleportees, such as myself, would pop into view in the state capitol complex in Santa Fe. This young staffer's responsibility was essentially to see that we got there. He would take a head count, and then we would be walked into one of the buildings there in the state capitol complex, and he would ask us our name first and last, have us spell our last name, and just make sure that we had arrived and not been lost in time space.
Interesting.
And that young staffer went on also to a very distinguished career in government. That individual was Bill Richardson, who would go on, of course, to become the congressman for the 3rd District of New Mexico, where several of the major defense labs are located.
Mm-hmm.
He would go on to become governor of New Mexico, energy secretary under President Clinton. I'm calling on these two distinguished public servants to join me under the rotunda at the Roundhouse in Santa Fe, the state capitol building, in light of the fact that Santa Fe essentially is the Kitty Hawk of teleportation. And I want them to acknowledge the following. One is that there's a higher interest in public service than serving the cause of state secrecy. And that's the overarching human interest that can be served and now needs to be served by the disclosure of life-advantaging information, such as is embodied in this revolutionary form of transport that our great American civilization developed and that we now need to share with the entire world.
I would think Richardson might be more apt to appear than Rumsfeld.
Well, you know,
that's my guess.
Cliff High, you know, one of your regular guests on Coast to Coast, has identified myself. I'm quite flattered that he's determined that I'm the first of the two major planetary whistleblowers that were predicted, you know, by the WebBot project. It's quite possible the second major planetary whistleblower will be none other than Governor Bill Richardson. If he steps forward, he'll certainly lend a high amount of credibility and stature to my claims, and simply a statement at a press conference that the project existed, that we were part of it, and that its major emphasis was this teleportation technology, I think will do much to persuade President Obama that now's the time to declassify this technology and use it to advantage every human being on our planet.
Without their testimony or their backing, both or even one, where are you?
I'm far advanced at this point, George. This is a case, you know, as a lawyer, I'm going to win. I've spent 10 years on this, thousands of hours, tens of thousands of dollars. I've done three major fact-finding trips to New Mexico. I've gathered accounts from 12, I won't call them whistleblowers because they're really just sources in my investigation. But I'm going to be revealing in my book the different individuals who were either military attachés to the project or some of the team leaders. I'll just give an example. Okay. I spoke with Joe Connison. And he was 90 years old. He was one of the other Parsons engineers attached to the project, like my dear father was. And at the end of the conversation, which he denied that he knew what I was talking about, that this teleportation project existed, that it implicated the Ralph M. Parsons Company. And this is a direct quote. He said, "A book, a movie, nobody on the outside knows about that stuff." Okay, so I have a set of telling. I either have revelations from project insiders or things that independent eyewitnesses saw, and also what we would call in the law statements against interest, essentially tacit admissions that different people who were on the project, who I went and, you know, found, have, you know, stated that essentially prove my major premises. So I'm confident that when my book is published, I'm not going to need the affirmation from Secretary Rumsfeld or Governor Richardson, but I'm really calling out to them as representatives of their respective parties, because this was a great accomplishment of our civilization, and we can really do much to restore American leadership in applied science and really do a lot to address global warming if we were to launch a program to implement teleportation globally. So I think that it would be helpful. I don't need them to affirm my story. It's going to be established independent of anybody else's affirmation of the truth of what I'm saying. But I would like to sort of harmonize the interests of the different factions in our society by having them step forward symbolically, urging the president that, listen, you know, at the very time that we were describing to the world our triumphant accomplishments in space exploration, we were concealing equally prodigious accomplishments in time-space exploration. I think that was a mistake. And I'm certain that we're going to be needing this technology to address our problems in the 21st century. So I think in that sense, Governor Richardson and Secretary Rumsfeld may recognize that joining my truth campaign and acknowledging the existence of this technology really will represent the highest form of leadership.
Will you have any information, or written or otherwise, Andy, that you could slap down on them and just say, "I know you were there"?
Well, I can't prove every last fact regarding my account, but after my book is published next year, readers are going to see that there's such a compression of detail and an inundation of information. I didn't just put together the information slapdash. I now have 224 passages for the book that are distillations of profound personal experience and deep political experience.
That's
so I'm certainly going to be able to name names. I'm certainly going to be able to describe, for example, that, you know, who was at the table when they were discussing the fact that young Bill, the staffer on the project, was destined to be governor of the very state that the project was in. I mean, I have direct quotes from things that were said around the table. I'm going to be identifying scholars of the U.S. military and the intelligence community who affirmed the existence of the project. Let me just cite one of those. Cliff Harris, the climatologist, I believe he's actually been on Coast.
Yes.
He was the youngest climatologist on the Ice Age studies that were performed for the CIA under Dr. Ivan Browning, when Browning was Director of Science and Technology for the CIA.
And Browning used to predict earthquakes in the Midwest, I believe.
Right. And your own Robert Felix, the Ice Age scholar who I know has been on Coast, directed me to Cliff. And Cliff absolutely affirmed my entire account. We spent about 2 hours on the phone and said, Andy, Ivan Browning was telling me about this at the time it was occurring, that teleportation had been achieved and that it was so advanced that DARPA was already sending American school children through vortal tunnels in time-space to test the technology and to train the children as time travelers. So I also have, as I mentioned, independent eyewitnesses. For example, I located a prominent Navy engineer by the name of Captain Lewis B. Wherry, who was working on a Navy project involving cooling systems for one of the classes of our nuclear submarines at Curtis Wright in the mid-70s. And he affirmed the fact that he saw the teleportation technology in Building 68 at Curtis Wright and asked other engineers there what it was, and they couldn't tell him. And then later it was removed from that room. I've met with some of the project principals. In the summer of 2003, I traveled to Santa Fe, and I met with Jack Pruitt, whose name appears prominently in both the Pegasus and the Montauk time travel accounts. I questioned Dr. Harold Agnew, who was essentially the Federal Science Administrator on Project Pegasus, of course, one of the most prominent proteges of Dr. Enrico Fermi. Agnew was the only human being who was present at all three critical stages of the Manhattan Project. He was at Chicago when the atomic pile there went critical. He was in New Mexico when the bomb was designed at Los Alamos and tested at Alamogordo. And he was even in the chase plane, the great artiste, following the Enola Gay when the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. When I called Harold in 2000, he was then 80 years of age, and I began to discuss my involvement in this secret teleportation project, and he didn't deny that the project existed. In fact, he furthered my investigation. He said, I'm afraid you're confused about the facts. The teleportation project wasn't at LANL, the Los Alamos National Labs. It was at Sandia. And in fact, I knew that was valid information because the teleport that we were being taken to quantum leap back to the tarmac at Curtis Wright in New Jersey, was in fact on the far right side of the Sandia campus. So I've gathered insider information like this, and I hesitate to call them whistleblowers because I'm in fact the whistleblower that's releasing this information. But I'm not the only hero of this investigation. My investigation has been advanced by many good and decent Americans who have helped me uncover the truth because they recognize the significance of this accomplishment in our American civilization and the potential to use this technology to really address our global environmental problems and create a 21st century that'll be far different and more advanced than the 20th century that we've just left.
Andy, tell us about the technology. I mean, was the machine, the apparatus, for example, for the teleportation, for creating this vortex, this hole, was it big? Was it small? What was it like?
Well, there were two teleporters that we used in the project. When they were training us to just become familiarized with jumping through vortal tunnels in time-space, which is a pretty heady experience, it was definitely as scary as the scariest amusement park ride to a child. We were jumping through a very small device there in Building 68 at Curtis Wright. It was essentially about the size of a bookshelf. I mean, each of the armatures of the device was about the height of a tall person to a child. And the field of energy we were jumping through was only about, I would say, about 10 feet across and maybe 8 feet high. So that wasn't intimidating at all. And we went through the vortal tunnel very quickly. In fact, the reason we didn't asphyxiate is because we were breathing a couple breaths of the air that we pushed into the this interstitial chasm, this vacuum in time-space that we were rushing through.
And does the tunnel seem long or is it very short?
It seemed very long. There were certain paradoxes when you would jump through the field of energy. You sensed that you were rushing through, let's say, the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City at 10,000 miles per hour, and yet you seemed to stay in the tunnel for a long time. But then you saw a pinprick of light in the distance that suddenly, essentially, came into full view very quickly, and then we completed our footfall in Santa Fe. So there were some time-space paradoxes or some time dilation going on, but I'm certain that we were only in the tunnel for perhaps even a split second, but it did seem like it lasted, you know, let's say 30 seconds or so.
How far out did they try to send people?
We were, with the small teleport at Curtis Wright, we could be sent initially in the summer of 1970. We noticed that they were keeping us in Santa Fe until nightfall, frequently taking us to dinner, let's say, to Howard Johnson's restaurant at 8 o'clock at night. And then when we would be driven to the Sandia campus to jump back to Curtis Wright in New Jersey, we realized that we were arriving in New Jersey about an hour after we had left, let's say in the bright sunlight of 1 o'clock in the afternoon or 11 in the morning. And we asked them, are you sending us back in time? And they acknowledged sheepishly that they were. And we asked, how far backward in time can you set us when we return from New Mexico? And at that time, they said 12 hours. But during the 3 years that I principally served on Project Pegasus, from fall of 1969 as a third grader until the summer of 1972, the Tesla model that they had there at Curtis Wright was able to send somebody backward or forward in time about 2 years. Because one of the things the American people deserve to know, certainly because these devices were developed with their tax dollars, and this is a major, I think, implication of my story and the book, is that time travel technology enabled the U.S. government to win the Cold War. Because among the things they were doing was giving adult project principals like my father sensitive military plans right there at the teleport. One time we arrived at Curtis Wright, and there was a military attaché there who gave my dad a mailing tube. And when I asked him what's in the tube, he said, plans to some of our most sensitive weapons systems. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, schematics of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, that particular jump was undertaken in around November 15th of 1971. However, when we arrived in New Mexico and then delivered the plans at Los Alamos and then went down to Albuquerque to just sort of hang out with some of my dad's friends in Old Town Albuquerque, he called me over to the table there in one of the restaurants there and said, Andy, tell Connie. Connie Chavez is a principal in the story. She was an old friend of my father's in Albuquerque that he first met when he was in New Mexico flight testing the ramjet engine for Curtis Wright in the early 1950s. And he brought me over to the table where they were sitting and said, Andy, tell Connie what year it is. And I said, what year it is? What do you mean, Dad? It's 1971. And they practically fell off their tables, off the table, off their chairs, because, in fact, from their perspective, in the time-space location they were in, that we arrived in, it was the beginning of the summer of 1973. And this is one of the implications of the story. What was occurring was that the U.S. government was teleporting military secrets into the future so that if, for example, Soviet intelligence agents tried to find those secrets, even if they knew of the existence of those documents, they wouldn't be able to recover them. Because they were stored not just in deep underground military bases in New Mexico, but deep underground military bases in New Mexico in the future. The other thing that was being done with teleportation during these early years of time-space exploration by the U.S. government is they were having individuals, again, like my dad, the adult participants, teleport to New Mexico, spend several years there, and then teleport back to the day they left, and that enabled them to brief the executive branch on the intervening 2 years of future events.
That's incredible. And where did they get the technology from, Andy? Was it E.T.? Did we develop it?
Well, I can certainly confirm that an intelligence funnel existed, that because they were essentially concerned about two factions, and they didn't know what the threat profile of these two factions were relative to the United States. I call them the Grays and the Reds. They were basically concerned about what the motives of the extraterrestrials that they knew had begun to visit our planet in great numbers after we began to explode atomic weapons during the war. They didn't know what the intention of different extraterrestrial species that are visiting us was. They were also concerned, believe it or not, with a land invasion of the continental United States by the Soviet Army. So they were throwing everything into the defense technical funnel. Tesla's work, the work of these two Vatican musicologists, Ernetti and Gemelli, who developed a device called a chronovisor that actually renders images of past and future events as a hologram. So they were gathering foreign intelligence that had gone on in other countries. They were clearly reverse engineering extraterrestrial technology from crashed saucer cases like the Roswell incident, and even deriving insights into different esoteric technologies from archaeological artifacts that had been collected for the last 100 or 150 years by the time these post-war projects were launched.
Andy, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. This is an incredible story, And one of the things I'm going to ask Andy when we come back is if he knows of John Teeter. And I've got to be direct with Andy. I'm going to ask him if he is John Teeter, the time traveler.
Coast to Coast AM with George Newry. All night long on the Big One, News Radio 1190 KEX.
And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Andy Wishago, the lawyer, the author, and the researcher. Andy, there's been a story that we've been tracking for years here on Coast to Coast by a time traveler named John Teeter. And I'd kick myself for the rest of my life if I didn't ask you, because you just seem like you know so much. Are you John Teeter, that time traveler?
In fact, I am not. But let me say that I've avoided discussing other time travel accounts, such as the Philadelphia Experiment and Project Montauk and also the John Teeter case, because in my estimation, all of them contain some valid information. And I don't know whether that's because they're disinformational ploys or they are apocryphal accounts that emerge from the actual insider experiences that people have that then morph into urban legends as a result of, you know, the post office effect, where people talk about their experiences and then ultimately the story gets altered.
Right.
I believe the John Teeter story, I will address this since you're asking, and that is I believe it's apocryphal, and let me tell you why I believe that's the case. You asked how far in time they sent us. Well, in terms of forward time travel, there were several jumps that we undertook from an old civic compound immediately outside of Cerrillos, New Mexico. Today it's called the Cerrillos Cultural Center. It was an old recreational facility built for Cerrillos, New Mexico by the WPA during the Depression. And in the summer of 1972, on the Olympic-sized basketball court inside the gym there, they constructed a huge device. It was this 60-foot-high black anvil-shaped piece of high technology that essentially powered a portal or doorway at the base of the device that was illuminated with a blue neon color. And we were trained that summer to run up a ramp and through that portal to access the year 2045. And we were doing that to pop into view in front of one of the project locations in the future. In other words, around 1970, the U.S. Defense Department established ongoing liaison with a time travel hub in the year 2045, located somewhere in the Southwest. In fact, they wouldn't tell us where the location was or what year it was there. We only learned that it was 2045 when several of the individuals from that time were back at Cerrillos repairing this device. The device was called a Stargate, and I want to make it clear to your listeners that I'm talking about a real project. It was called Project Pegasus, and there was an actual advanced time travel device called a Stargate. And we find those two words dropped in, of course, into Stargate Atlantis on television, the first episode of which was Project Pegasus. I just want to make it clear that I wasn't influenced by their information, but in fact, I believe their information plot lines and so forth may have been inspired by the actual Project Pegasus. But let me just say that the reason that I believe that the John Teeter story is apocryphal, well, there are really two reasons.
Okay.
When we jump to 2045, at least on that timeline, there had been no disintegration such as John Teeter describes, no social breakdown as a result of,
Civil War.
A civil war in the U.S.
Yeah.
The 2045 that I physically visited for the U.S. Department of Defense to recover microfilmed summaries of intervening events and take them back to 1972. We were actually jumping through the wall of one of the offices there where the teleport had actually been recessed into the wall.
Huh.
And we were popping into view in the grounds immediately around the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook site north of Pagosa Springs, Colorado. In that 2045 timeline that we were visiting to recover and basically give the U.S. Defense Department and this project under Donald Rumsfeld a history of the future, there had been no civil war. In fact, the future was a pretty nice place to visit. The buildings were very beautiful. The environment was sort of a garden city, where there was a sort of a balance between the built and the natural environment. And very advanced activities were going on. I mean, one of the things I remember is people were going by on the sidewalk on the Sedgeways that Dean Kamen has invented in our time.
Yeah.
So there had clearly been a positive transformation of society that involved not just appropriate technologies such as the Sedgeway of Dean Kamen, but also the use of teleportation to obviate all these very polluting forms of transportation. And so I don't believe that the storyline contained in the John Teeter account is true, at least for the timeline that I believe that we're on.
Tell me about the chronovisor that you were talking about.
Right. The chronovisor was the second major emphasis of Project Pegasus. They were attempting to familiarize us with the psychological and physiological sensations of teleporting, but they were also training us to be reliable observers and to be able to communicate back to the project things that we witnessed in these holograms that they were propagating with these devices called chronovisors, either by looking at the hologram or standing inside the hologram and essentially experiencing a form of virtual time travel whereby we were then inserted in that past or future event that was being captured in the hologram. This device emerged during the 1940s as a result of the work of two Vatican musicologists, Pellegrino Ernetti and another priest assisting him by the name of Pierre Maria Gemelli. And what they were doing was they were studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants to see why, for example, Gregorian chants have healing properties.
Mm-hmm.
And they were developing a specialized microphone to split the signals of the Gregorian chants. And to their astonishment, something that Gemelli's father had said to him in childhood, I know it's the interesting parallel to my own experience, but a past event that was sort of attached to Gemelli came through the microphone. And they were astonished that they had captured and amplified the signal of a past event. Because everything that has happened, is happening, or is going to happen is going on simultaneously somewhere in the quantum hologram. And so this was a breakthrough where they realized they had developed a technology that could identify information from a past event and amplify it where we are on our timeline. So they partnered with the most distinguished Italian, they were working at the Catholic University of Milan, and they partnered with the most distinguished Italian scientist of their time, the eminent physicist Dr. Enrico Fermi.
Yes.
Who I would note was also the mentor of Harold Agnew at Chicago. Agnew, of course, being the administrator of Project Pegasus. So I think the most significant figure, in fact, in the hidden history of U.S. time travel technology is, in fact, Enrico Fermi, and not John von Neumann or Albert Einstein or other people who have been suggested. But in any case, they partnered with Fermi, and by 1952, they had a two-dimensional chronovisor that they claimed they had used to tune in the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth.
Oh, wow.
And I know that that event was captured in a hologram because in the summer of 1972, I viewed about a 20-minute black-and-white documentary of a hologram showing the crucifixion of Jesus. And it was the most harrowing thing I've ever watched. So the chronovisor then was passed along by the Vatican to the United States government for further development. And so by the time I was attached to Project Pegasus as a seven-year-old going on eight in fall of 69, they had already developed the capacity to render three-dimensional holograms of past and future events. The first hologram image of a past event that I witnessed was in the fall of 1970 at a national security watch post in Flemington, New Jersey, where technicians were not only generating holograms of past events, but filming them with 16-millimeter film. And I was standing by a device, and the technician pointed to it and said, "Boys, do you know what that is?" And it was an 8-inch circular screen. I said, "Oh, that's some closed circuit or public television broadcast of a reenactment of the signing of the Declaration of Independence." And he said, well, no, it can't be the signing of the Declaration, because look who this is here. And he pointed to George Washington standing on a dais. And he said, look who's sitting here on this couch. And I could see the very corpulent appearance of Benjamin Franklin with his huge domed head. He was a very large individual yeah. for his time. And I said, oh, that must be, if that's Washington, that must be a reenactment of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. And then as we were leaving that lab, where these individuals were taping the past, he turned to me and said, that's not a reenactment. That is the signing of the U.S. Constitution. Okay, so I know to a personal certainty, having been an eyewitness to Chronovision, that Ernetti's claim that they had filmed the crucifixion, which has been kicked around in parascience circles literally for decades, is in fact valid, not only because I saw past events being tuned in by similar chronovisors, but because I saw a film of a three-dimensional modeling of the crucifixion of Jesus. And so the chronovisor was the second major emphasis of the project, and we went on many probes, primarily the past events, by standing on a stage. There was a crystal array in the ceiling that my father explained was driving an electromagnetic signal through bismuth crystals. And then there were two men operating devices beyond the stage that looked very much like closed-circuit TV cameras. Mm-hmm. And as my dad explained, they were fixing the time and the space coordinate that allowed him to control the hologram and tune in a specific moment in time. So I went on, I would say, perhaps 20 probes to the past and several to the future in three- and fourth-dimensional chronovisors that were located at different locations in New Jersey and in one location in New Mexico during those years.
One of the most incredible things you've talked about, Andy, is the claim that the government identifies future American presidents with this time ability, briefs them in advance. Tell me about this time.
Yeah. You know, I'm a lawyer here in Washington. I'm essentially a sworn constitutional officer in the sense that I'm sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution, not just the Constitution of my home state here in Washington. And I'm troubled by the fact that essentially the protocols for selecting the President of the United States and possibly the Vice President and other officials, but certainly the President, has been breached by time travel. Let me explain how. I think the analogy here is the way in which the advent of atomic weapons, that is to say, that form of technical development, outpaced social organization and political protocols. I think the most politically significant implication of my research and my experiences is the fact that I know to a personal certainty, indeed in a moral certainty, that our government identified essentially many of our recent presidents in the early 1970s, and I know based on encounters with several of them, not only that they had been identified, but had actually been briefed about their destinies as president. Let me say that when I was on the project, the overwhelming consensus of the project principals, whether they were scientists, federal bureaucrats, engineers from Parsons and GE and so forth, was that to the extent that we were knowledgeable about some future events, we should not play God and intervene and engage in quantum engineering to alter the future. In fact, we should just use the information we were gathering to involve the government in contingency planning for significant future events. But one thing I know they've been doing on the gradient, where they've been actually using information from the future, is to identify and brief our presidents. And the presidents that I know were identified following the advent of quantum access in the early 70s were Presidents Carter, both Presidents Bush, President Clinton, and President Obama. So let me just share with you how I know that.
Okay.
Let's take Jimmy Carter first. When I was a child on the project in the early 1970s, in the summer of 1971, I had been identified as the whistleblower on the project. And that was very sensitive, not only because my dad was one of the project engineers, but because I was one of the few kids out of 140 American school children involved who had jumped through a series of hoops and they were already using to send to 2045 and go on other important assignments for the project. And as a result of retrieving information from the future about what we're doing right now, George, in terms of facilitating my disclosure effort, becoming the whistleblower regarding Project Pegasus and the technologies that it developed, they began to retrieve my personal writings from the future. I know they were in possession of my book about Pegasus and other books that I've either written or edited or will write or edit in the future from perspective of 2009. One of those books was the treatise that my friend and colleague Alfred Lambermont Weber, another one of your former guests,
yes,
published in 2005 entitled Exopolitics. I edited that book for Alfred as a professional writer.
Okay.
That book is a quantum artifact because during one lunch when I was on Project Pegasus in Albuquerque, my father left the restaurant, came back to the table with a black leather diplomatic security satchel. It had an identifying buck slip on the front of it. It had apparently been sourced from some sort of esoteric or clandestine archive there in New Mexico. And he pulled out the 2005 edition of Exopolitics. And he and several other people at the table discussed the front pages of that work. And somebody said, well, do they know who Jimmy Carter is? It says here President Jimmy Carter, because Alfred had begun his work with a quotation by President Carter.
Right.
And my father said, yes, we've determined that he's the lieutenant governor of Georgia. So that was 70-71. I believe that was 71.
That's amazing.
Also, during the 70-71-72 time frame, when I was personally attached to the project, they were bringing future American leaders literally through the social network that the project comprised. So at one lunch, for example, Vice President Cheney was present. At another lunch, George H.W. Bush, his wife Barbara, and their son George W. Bush were guests of the project. They were sharing lunch with us. At that lunch, I was about 9-10 years old. George W. Bush was in his mid-20s, and I remember him saying to me directly, he was joking. In fact, he was going from table to table where all the project people were dining, and he was joking, my daddy and I are going to be president. And I believe that he must have just been briefed because he was electric with life. In fact, I remember George W. Bush being right in front of my face saying that, and he was literally the most energetic, animated person I have ever met. The implications, of course, of this are something that I'm sure that Dan Rather would be interested in, because when Dan went in search of where President Bush 43 was in 1973, I think the reason that was such a sensitive subject to be investigating is because, in all likelihood, George W. Bush was being trained for the presidency in 1973, because I know in 1971, as a young college graduate, he already knew that he and his father were destined to be president. That's certainly a strange thing to be told when you're 25, that
sure
both
is.
You and your dad are going to be the chief executive and the leader of the free world. I know also to a personal, a moral, a scientific certainty that President Clinton was also identified as a future American president. Let me explain how I know that. When we were teleporting back and forth between the Curtis Wright facility at Woodridge, New Jersey, and the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds, or from Sandia, the Sandia labs back to New Jersey, sometimes a technical glitch would occur where the Vortal tunnel that had been opened up in the time-space continuum would begin to collapse. And we were decanted to a grassy area behind the Swage Lock Company headquarters in Solon, Ohio. We would then walk around the parking lot and through the front door of that one-story sprawling building. And it was during one of those emergency interruptions of a teleporting that one of the people teleporting with us said to my father, Ray, everybody on the project says that a young man named Bill Clinton is going to be one of our next future presidents. Tell me, could it be true? And my father said, yep, that's what they say.
What a story. Back with more and phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.
You're tuned to Coast AM on News Radio 1190 KEX.
And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We'll take your phone calls with Andrew. Andrew, you were talking about Bill Clinton, and your father hit it right on the head, didn't he?
He certainly did. In fact, he mentioned it again. We were camping at Mount Shasta in the late 70s, and he asked my brother and I what the future would hold. And I think I said that that flying car featured in Star Wars would become dominant by the time I was an adult. And he said, well, boys, I can tell you this. One of our next future presidents is going to be Bill Clinton. And I really wasn't thinking about my project experiences as a youngster, even there in my late teens or mid-teens. And we found that statement so funny that we actually fell off the picnic table bench laughing at his statement that somebody named Bill Clinton was going to be president. But that, in fact, was sort of the strange culture we were living in there when I was, you know, sort of having these parallel experiences. I had a very wonderful and happy childhood growing up in New Jersey, but I had essentially been involved in, you know, the cult of intelligence at a very young age. And I think I repressed a lot of it. And so even by my mid or late teens, I was already not really connecting that kind of statement back to things I had heard when I was on the project as a 7, 8, 9-year-old. But I also might I'd like to add also that I mentioned President Obama. That's a little bit stranger, and I think may even indicate that the hand of the Almighty in some way has been involved in furthering my truth campaign. I mentioned President Obama. Now, the strange thing about that is I met President Obama when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I don't have the precise date, but we know it was either the spring or summer break of 1982, because I had interviewed Buckminster Fuller in the fall of 81, and my meeting with the young Barack Obama occurred before he graduated from Columbia in summer of 83. I was having a discussion with a South African anti-apartheid activist on Bruin Walk, and I was sharing with him some of my thoughts in political economy, particularly the direction that the transnational corporations would be taking over the next several decades. And he said, listen, I have a house guest I'd like to introduce you to. I think he'd be fascinated by what you have to say about what Bucky Fuller shared with you and some of your ideas in political economy. And so I went with this individual over to his house in West Los Angeles. And I had a discussion that lasted about a half hour with a young student who was back in Los Angeles after having spent a year at Columbia. And he explained to me that his name was Barack Obama and that he was in L.A. Visiting his friends from his 2 years at Occidental College in Eagle Rock, California. Mm-hmm. And our discussion about the corporations, I was taking a much more radical take on where the corporations were going, the possibility that they might enslave humanity, destroy the environment. Barack Obama was taking a much more sort of liberal position that they were necessary institutions in society, a much more lawyerly analysis. And so our conversation unraveled essentially into an argument. And our host said to me, you better be nice to him, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday. So the incredibly serendipitous thing is that as somebody, I mean, I'm sure that neither of them at the time understood that ultimately I would be able to make sense of that comment, because I, in fact, had previously in my life been one of the children attached to the very classified defense-related research and development program where quantum access technologies were developed that would allow the U.S. government to identify a particular person of interest, like a future president, and literally approach them and brief them. But clearly, now Barack Obama was born in August of 61, myself in September of 61. We're literal contemporaries. And that meeting with President Obama occurred when we were 20 years old. So in the case of President Obama, he had 27 years to prepare psychologically for the presidency. I presume he must have been briefed by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his mentor at Columbia. Zbigniew Brzezinski had just served as National Security Advisor for President Carter.
He sure was.
But
truly a globalist, Andy.
Yes, and I know I can date it to that time frame, so that indicates that after spending a year at Columbia, by that time, a young Barack Obama had already been approached by our government and at least informed about his destiny. You know, in a similar way, I was informed of my destiny as somebody who would be principally associated in society with the discovery of life on Mars, not simply because I was told that when I was a child attached to Project Pegasus, but I was shown and asked to read my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, that I published last year in 1971. I was shown the 2008 version and required to read it, And when I asked, well, why do I have to read this paper that I'm going to write, you know, 37 years from now, they said, so that when you do write it, it contains as much data about Mars as possible. So I think the significance of these experiences is that there was some attempt that was being made to take information from the future and use it in the present to channel certain outcomes that they either thought were beneficial for the country or that would help the people involved in carrying out very serious responsibilities on behalf of the country, like the president. But it is a pretty profound implication of my story, and it's true, and I think we have to do a lot of soul-searching and maybe even hold a national debate as a society. What are we going to do now about the presidency, now that we know that the presidents, in fact, have been given prior knowledge of their destinies as president? It's an incredibly complicated thing to resolve politically and philosophically.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go. This hour will go by very quickly. East of the Rockies, Boston, Mass, we go. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to speak with you and your guest. I have a question about the holographic film that your guest viewed on Jesus. And I know in another show it was mentioned that the police arrest report of Jesus was on the Internet, and they give descriptions when they arrest someone. And he was listed as 4'8" and a hunchback. And I just wanted to know if this is true, or did he look, more like what they depict in photo, paintings of him, and things like that.
That's a fascinating question. The individual being crucified in the hologram, or actually it was a documentary, black and white documentary film of a hologram of somebody from that era being crucified. They had concluded it was Jesus of Nazareth, but of course there were something like 600 men of Jesus' time and age who, in fact, were executed in that way during the period when he was crucified. The individual in the film was very emaciated. He had black hair and a beard. He was essentially a European male with a sort of an aquiline nose and slightly droopy eyes, not unlike, in fact, Sylvester Stallone's. But he was in a great deal of anguish as a result of dying in that manner. The reason I do believe it was Jesus of Nazareth is a number of things that occurred during the film were right out of the gospel accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, including the Roman centurion Longinus leaping up actually on 1 foot, because the individual being crucified was on about 14 feet off the ground. And so Longinus took the end of his spear and actually speared the side of the individual being crucified. There were also women who were coming and praying at the foot of the cross. And so I'm not sharing this information to advocate a particular religious interpretation of the events, but the film I saw definitely closely followed the scriptural account of Jesus' crucifixion.
Okay, let's go to Springfield, Mass. First-time caller. Andy, go ahead. You're on with us.
Hi, I just have 3 questions. For the guest?
3?
Well,
let's go one at a time.
Okay. You say that there's time travel, so does that mean that there's, like, time cops for, like, maybe rogue agents that decide that they're going to go off and do other things?
All right. As question one, Andy.
I have no knowledge of time cops, but I do know that in one of the seminars about teleportation, one of the reasons that the program gave for not introducing the technology socially was the concern that rogue elements, or in fact they mentioned organized criminal networks, would get hold of the technology and improve it, and in that way oppress society by, for example, committing crimes and then teleporting elsewhere to evade arrest. So certainly the issue of policing teleportation was within the contemplation of the program sponsors, but I don't remember the notion of time cops ever being articulated any further than that.
All right, number 2, Andy.
Was Gene Roddenberry the creator of Star Trek from the future? Or
I don't know. I think one thing I can add to the discussion of science fiction is that it's a literary genre that was partially developed by the U.S. intelligence community and military to take information from real clandestine projects and place them in fictional accounts, so that the public would either be confused about the nature of things like new technical developments that were being kept secret, or if somebody who had been an insider pointed to the technology or described their experiences, their accounts could be attributed to a fictional genre. So, for example, with Star Trek, they were revealing a teleportation technology right around the time that it, in fact, emerged in the defense technical community in the United States, but they were depicting a form of teleportation that was literally the opposite of the teleportation technology that had been developed. But I don't have any information suggesting that the brilliant Gene Roddenberry was anything more than a great creative mind from our own time.
And your last one, Andy?
Is there any way I can get involved?
Oh, now that's a good question, too. How does he get involved?
Well, my Mars research project is at www.projectmars.net. I would urge you to become a supporter and participant in Mars. And my truth campaign, Project Pegasus, is at www.projectpegasus.net. And so I would urge you to visit those websites and join my campaign. Also, I'm up on Facebook. We have two groups, one Project Pegasus and the other entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars on Facebook, and you can keep abreast of my truth campaign on those two sites on Facebook.
Okay, next up, we go to John in Sun City, California. You're up with us. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, other than maybe giving me some lotto numbers in the future, I have a question regarding needing Rumsfeld and Richardson to confirm what you were saying. Wouldn't it be simpler, since the chances of them doing so is very nil, couldn't you write something down, since you know of these other things like Clinton and Bush's being made president, your knowledge of some of the things in the future, in the near future, write it down, put it in a vault somewhere, like with George, and then unlock it in 6 months or a year and say that these six or eight things that you said would happen 6 months earlier came true? Wouldn't that be proof enough that what you're saying is confirmation?
Well, this idea comes up, and I'm sort of asked to prove my claims by being a soothsayer. Let me just say this. My project experiences on Project Pegasus occurred 40 years ago when I was age 7 to 11. I'm now 48. I've spent the last 10 years investigating what happened to me and writing down as much as I can remember. Things like being able to correlate the one lunch in 1971 when both President Bush's were present and apparently had recently been briefed on their presidencies are just one episode in an entire lifetime that I've been able to go back and identify as having happened on the project as a result of doing literally 10 years worth of memory work. So I think that's a very logical question that you ask, but it's not a requirement that I'm going to impose on myself, because my account is really a memoir that I've recovered from the recesses of my own life experience 4 decades ago. And in fact, if I had not gone about the process of recovering the memories, that is to say, focusing on them for 10 years, I'm not sure I would have been able to correlate much of the information. I would have simply forgotten it and moved on with my career as a lawyer and as a writer. So I don't want to position myself as a soothsayer, because essentially I've been able to identify the things that were predicted about the future because they were referenced in discussions 40 years ago, and I've done the memory work to recover them. But I'm not prepared, for example, to say who the next president is going to be.
Can you say, Andy, whether we get hit by an asteroid or anything like that?
Well, there was catastrophic information that was revealed in one of the time probes. Let me describe it. I don't remember anything involving being struck by an object from space. But there was a very, very basically dangerous chronovisor probe that was undertaken on November 5th of 1971 at the ITT Defense Communications Facility in Nutley, New Jersey, which then and now is literally physically adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency branch that's there in Nutley, New Jersey. And for that probe to the future, there was such a high-intensity light generated by the crystal array in the chronovisor that we actually had to wear a crystal helmet and a protective spacesuit-like garb that was sputter-coated with titanium to literally physically protect us from the energy field that we were placed in. During that probe, we went forward for about a half hour to remotely view the status of the U.S. Supreme Court building as it would appear on the Mall in Washington, D.C. in the year 2013. And I do believe that year was selected because of the concern regarding the Mayan prophecy and what may befall us, on December 21st of 2012?
2012. Yeah.
And what I saw during that probe and reported to the lieutenant commander from the Office of Naval Intelligence, who debriefed me when my clothing was removed on the stage, my boots were poured out, not, I believe, from water, but actually my own perspiration. It was so hot in that suit. I was taken down the hall, and the lieutenant commander from ONI asked me, okay, Andy, tell me about the target. The target is what we had been trained at some exercises at Curtis Wright to actually focus on and look quickly to the left and right when the forward momentum of this particular probe stopped. And essentially what this was that event, as it was forming prior to the collapse of the wave function in that area of the quantum hologram where that future event on that timeline was stored but had not yet occurred from the perspective of our position in the time-space continuum. And what I saw and reported to the Office of Naval Intelligence is that the U.S. Supreme Court building was under about 100 feet of brackish water. In fact, there was algae growing on the stately columns in the front of that building. But I hasten to add that we can't use that information to be apprehensive about the idea that there will be a catastrophe in 2012 involving, let's say, substantial coastal flooding that would place Washington, D.C. underwater, because all of the chronovisor probes were to adjacent timelines in the multiverse. In fact, I think something significant about my investigation that I can offer to the discussion about time travel, both in science and parascience, is that Project Pegasus proved the existence of the multiverse, the notion that the quantum hologram consists of a multiple set of adjacent timelines that are essentially similar, but that differ slightly and are sort of densely packed, internested sets of timelines. Because when I was being sent multiple times to the assassination of President Lincoln, I had been trained to go through the lobby and up the stairs and behind his box there at Ford's Theater. Every time I was sent there, something different would happen. And then later in 1971, I was present at the meeting in the evening at the Sandia Auditorium where time travel to the past involving chronovision using children was shut down. Because in the words of the administrator who was announcing the termination of that part of the program, every time we send the same child or a different child to the same event, it changes a little bit. So when I describe this probe to 2013, in which clearly there had been a mass disaster, in which presumably the entire eastern seaboard had been flooded with a substantial amount of water, God knows from what, yeah. Global warming, maybe the collapse of La Palma in the Canary Islands into the Atlantic, perhaps a meteor strike in one of the world's oceans. I'm saying that that information had been detected on one timeline, but that doesn't mean that we're in the timeline where that event will occur.
You're very good, Andy. I got to tell you, it's a very compelling story. We'll be back in a moment with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.
You're tuned to Coast AM on News Radio 1190 KEX.
And welcome back to Coast with Andrew Bashago, the attorney, the author as well. Let's take some more of your calls. You ready for the final calls, Andy?
Yes, let's fire away.
Peter in Queens, New York. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I'd like to ask a two-front question, one on Christ and the other one on DVD copies. On Christ, there have been various variations, like certain famous Catholic saints and mystics had different variations on how he really looked like. So did he look like the Holy Shroud, a Turan? What age was he? Did he have nails in his wrist or in his hands? The other question is the great composers like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Franz Liszt doing their own works, and Babe Ruth playing a nine-inning game in his prime in the 20s. In a modern video, DVD, audio, a copy, and all that. These we wouldn't get variations because we know how these individuals look like. So that's the two questions I like to ask you.
Well, the individual I saw being crucified, who the project had concluded was Jesus of Nazareth, I think the closest depiction of him would be perhaps the El Greco rendering of Jesus. This individual was very thin, had very dark hair, aquiline features, a very narrow face, droopy eyes.
How old was he?
He looked his age.
40 years old, as the modern scholars say. He was born 4 B.C. or 6 B.C. Would you say he's about 40 or 30 or 33?
He could have been. I couldn't really say whether he was anywhere from 33 to 40, but he was certainly in that age range.
And did he have nails in his wrist like the Holy Shroud predicts or traditional?
Yes. Well, the one thing that was conspicuous to a child who was growing up in the Roman Catholic tradition and seeing what was being purported to be the actual crucifixion of Jesus was that he wasn't on a cross. This individual was on a pole, and there was a very short cross piece that he had been nailed to through the wrists, maybe about a 3-foot cross beam on something that looked about the size of a modern telephone pole. And he was in a great deal of anguish, and that was quite disturbing to see. There was a crown of thorns. I mentioned the women who came to pray at the foot of his cross, and also the Roman centurion reaching up to lance him in the side. Let me just say in reference to your question, in response to it, he did not resemble the face in the shroud at all. That individual looks much more auguste and robust.
But remember what you said yourself and what the saints have said themselves. There are variations. I mean, there are different variations of him. Even the saints had different, Sister Aida of Spain and Catherine Emmerich that Mel Gibson had his Passion of Christ go by, they both had different variations of Christ. And like you had said earlier, going back in the past or whatever, there was different variations of certain events or certain scenes or whatever.
Right.
And Andy, don't you also think, though, that a 40-year-old of that era would look much older than a 40-year-old of this era?
Certainly. And this individual was very emaciated and was in a great deal of pain. I would say that he certainly looked like depictions of Jesus. I would say that the actor that was cast in the Mel Gibson production, that wasn't very far off, although he looked a little bit more Mediterranean than that, or Middle Eastern.
Was that James Cabiel? I don't know how he pronounced
it. Yeah, the individual in the documentary that I was watching, of ostensibly the actual crucifixion, was more swarthy looking, more of a Middle Eastern phenotype, very thin, as if he had been starving for weeks or even longer and suffering for a great deal of time before he was crucified. Regarding the caller's second question regarding the great individuals in the past, I think that's one of the positive potentials of Chronovision that undergirds my truth campaign regarding these quantum access technologies. Imagine being able to go into the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and seeing Bach perform or seeing the U.S. Constitution being signed. I mean, we can watch modern events that have been filmed, let's say Martin Luther King giving the I Have a Dream speech, and be profoundly moved. Imagine what would happen culturally if we could go to virtual museums and libraries where a protector that would be in control of the Chronovision technology so that it couldn't be abused to violate people's privacy, but that would uphold a high standard of quantum access and allow the public to view different significant and inspiring moments in history. I think that would culturally be a very profound resource. So in that sense, I think we should start thinking about using these quantum access technologies to spark a cultural renaissance in our global civilization as a result of going back and viewing inspiring moments from the past, not just in American history, but in all of world history.
How did you feel about your father allowing you to go through this program? Did you ever get upset with him, or were you happy about it?
Then and now, I feel like he permitted me to enjoy a profound cosmic privilege. Certainly one of the funny scenes in the movie is going to be the fact that there was a point where I had a little temper tantrum, and I said to one of his friends in Albuquerque, he doesn't give me credit for anything. And, in fact, he wasn't giving me credit for serving in a classified defense project where time travel was going on, and I was responsible for undertaking it. So we shared in a special way as father and son in the program. I think perhaps the abiding human or literary theme of my book is that we're all alive for only a brief moment in time, and the kind of interludes that I had with my father when we were serving together on Project Pegasus now have a very profound resonance with me, and I'm glad that we were able to essentially participate as father and son at the dawn of the time-space age. I view it as an incredible privilege that we had, not just as father and son, but simply as human individuals who were there at literally the inception of time travel and the time-space age. So I look back with great fondness and some sense of poignancy about the fact that my father is deceased and he can't share in this next phase of my life, where I'm bringing public attention to the fact that these technologies were developed and that we should be trying to enhance their positive potential and prevent their negative potential. I think he'd be quite proud of me.
Let's go to Jennifer in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, hello. Well, I have to ask, since we have had this technology for 40 years now and we were able to develop it in the first place, I think common sense would say that if there are other intelligent species and civilizations out there, that they would come across this technology too. So did you meet any extraterrestrials in your time travels, and did they look human?
And that's a very complicated question. I'm going to go into some of this in the book. I had a set of contact experiences as a child with the Greys that I really don't think add a lot to the discussion about human ET contact. When I went and I plotted everything that happened in Pegasus, and then I examined where these episodes of extraterrestrial contact occurred, obviously I was examining whether my memories of having served in Project Pegasus resulted from extraterrestrial contact. I was trying to disprove that premise in the same way that I was controlling for other factors like fantasy, delusion, government mind control, mistake, and so forth. And what I ended up finding, and I think does add to the whole study of extraterrestrial or interdimensional human contact, is they seem to have been appearing as a result of the fact that I was appearing in the realm that they occupy, that they are operational in, which is the supraluminal realm of fourth and fifth dimension functioning. So I'm going to describe in the book, for example, one time I was moving forward in time in the Montauk chair. One of the quantum access technologies is the chair described in the Montauk Project books by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, which is essentially a magnetic transducer that prompts an astral projection of a person's consciousness to subjective moments in their own personal futures. In other words, it works a form of psycho-spiritual time travel. And during one of those probes to my own future, the forward momentum stopped, and I looked to my right, and there were four gray extraterrestrials observing me, and then I continued to move forward. So I guess what I'm implying here or describing is that there seemed to be extraterrestrial or interdimensional monitoring of some of the time-space exploration activities that DARPA sent me on. And I think maybe that's a contribution to the whole discussion of who or what the extraterrestrials are and what realm of consciousness or reality they're actually functioning in. It's actually the higher time-space dimensions, I believe. I do not believe that they're necessarily biological creatures. I think they are, in fact, interdimensional creatures of a higher order.
All right, let's go to John in San Francisco. Hey, John, thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah, what an incredible program. I have a few questions. Hopefully I can get through them all.
Sure.
Real quick. George sort of touched on the first one. What did you feel about your father, you know, volunteering you for this project, top secret project, where he didn't know if you were going to come back alive or not? I mean, I find that hard to believe that you share some kind of pride with that. The second question is, you mentioned that this teleportation can help our environmental or some other civilian problems that we're experiencing here on Earth. How exactly can this technology do that? Because you didn't go into details on that. And number three, if your story is true, why are you even allowed to talk about this? I mean, this is pretty heavy-duty stuff. Aren't you concerned for your safety?
Okay, let's first.
Well, during 10 years investigating what happened to me in Project Pegasus, I was definitely concerned about my safety. In fact, in the summer of 2003, during my first fact-finding trip to New Mexico, a set of meetings were facilitated with different people. One of them was Governor Richardson. Another was Jack Pruitt, who had been one of the team leaders on Project Pegasus. A third individual I met with in the parking lot of this was in June of 2003, of the Wolf Creek Pass Ski Lodge, which obviously was not being frequented because it was the middle of the summer and nobody was skiing. And during that meeting, I was essentially told by a representative of the executive office of the president, this would be George W. Bush's administration, the following. I was basically told that my memories of having been involved in Project Pegasus were valid, that the project involved black technologies that represented sensitive national security secrets, that I was admonished or being advised to cease and desist from investigating my experiences, talking about them, or writing about them, and then if I didn't do that, they couldn't, quote-unquote, guarantee my survival. So by that point into my investigation, I was literally being instructed by the executive branch to terminate my investigation. And I decided not to, primarily because I concluded that we really can't implement our destinies as individuals if we hold on to our fear of death. Achieving great purposes requires basically some form of fearlessness in the sense that you have to let go of worrying about the consequences of what you're doing. And so I resolved then to basically patronize them and tell them, sure, I'll shut up. But then I quietly continued my investigation. It's now gone on for an additional 6 years, during which I've recovered a lot more data. So, yes, I was actively concerned during my investigation that I might be assassinated as a result of investigating what happened to me and then later publishing this expose that goes into one of the more sensitive areas of national security activities, even implicating the U.S. presidency. Regarding your point about my dad, I think it might be helpful to go back and consider who he was. He had been a combat medic during World War II and had seen many children who had been killed in war. He had worked on the ramjet engine and the B-70 strategic bomber immediately after the July 1952 overflight of our nation's capital by, nine disc-shaped craft flying at clocked at 7,000 miles per hour by Langley Air Force Base. So he was profoundly involved in classified aerospace projects that were being launched to protect the people of our planet from any potential threat that the extraterrestrials posed. So he had that degree of concern and involvement in protecting life on Earth, human life. I think it's clear also that he didn't volunteer me into the project. I was, in fact, what happened was he was contacted at work by the U.S. Army and informed that I would be in the project. And that's actually one of the mysteries that I haven't been able to resolve in my investigation. In the final analysis, it remains a mystery as to why I was selected. We know that Admiral Rickover had launched a project called Project Talent in 1959. To identify young Americans who possessed either extraordinary intelligence, psychic ability, or leadership potential, and to cultivate their human abilities in these types of programs, even expose them to defense projects so they could later contribute to them after getting more education. So I think it's safer to identify the fact that I was more identified by Project Talent as somebody the government wanted to work with than I was volunteered into a classified defense project by my dad. It's also clear that at a certain stage, around 1967-68, when I was brought into the project, the U.S. government was already in possession of information about me pertaining to my Mars research. That is to say, I had already been identified as a person of interest, as somebody who, like Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra and all the great pioneers of Mars anomaly research that George has had on the show, that I too would play a part in contributing to that literature. So I think it's a very complicated profile. In fact, my father was approached. He didn't just say, well, let's use my son in this, just because he was one of the project engineers. And then regarding the environmental issue that you raise, this actually came up in a seminar that I took part in. You know, imagine Al Gore is studying with Roger Revelle about global warming at Harvard as an undergraduate at this time. I'm a child participant in Project Pegasus, and we're having a similar discussion. I remember saying during a seminar, well, if we use teleportation, we'll remove from the atmosphere all of those pollutants and particulates that are currently being put into the world's atmosphere by planes, trains, and automobiles. So the environmental significance of teleportation is that it'll allow us to obviate most of the pollution that is currently being contributed to the global atmosphere from transportation, and that's a significant component of the global warming equation.
And so, Andy, why did they call the project Pegasus?
Well, when we were told what the project descriptor was, you know, the project title, and it was explained how classified defense projects are given one name or the other, Project Manhattan, Project Zero, and so forth, Project Montauk. We were told that sometimes the naming was arbitrary, as in the case of Project Manhattan. In the case of Project Pegasus, we were told that the reason that Pegasus was selected is because the technologies would take us over the rainbow, that in the same way that Pegasus in Greek mythology, flew to the summit of Mount Olympus, these technologies would take us into non-ordinary experience, some of which would seem almost magical or fantastic in its reach. And in fact, that is what happened. There were times when I was on Project Pegasus involved in these different forms of quantum access where I literally felt a zeal about what we were doing. I felt like a yo-yo on the end of a string. I had this deep sense of profound enjoyment and excitement about the fact that I was literally on the cutting edge of human experience. Other times, we were experiencing things that were quite terrifying. But I believe that they called the project Project Pegasus because a part of our experience on the project would be accessing non-ordinary realities that would be as magical as Pegasus flying to the summit of Mount Olympus.
Fascinating. Andy, give out your website, would you please?
Right. My Mars writings, and I'm really trying to create an international movement of research associates who will, as I have done in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, show through works of natural history, through photo analysis and text, that Mars is an inhabited planet, and therefore we need to protect it from human beings from Earth. That work is currently up on the Internet. It's an evolving website at projectmars.net. And my cause to try to have the U.S. government declassify teleportation so that we can use it to advantage human beings around our planet is at a site that's just under development right now called projectpegasus.net.
And we will make sure we link all of those for you, Andy. We'll be back in a moment with Craig Hewlett on Coast to Coast AM.